call our first case of the morning, State v. Neves, 14-8P-1623. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
Please
go. May it please the Court, Deputy Solicitor General Daniel Lennington for the State. The Court of Appeals should be reversed in this case because a casual conversation between two inmates does not implicate the Confrontation Clause. The Confrontation Clause is only implicated by the statements of a witness, and in Crawford v. Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court made clear that a witness is only someone who makes a testimonial statement. A casual conversation between two inmates in jail is not a testimonial statement.
But was this really a casual conversation when the jailhouse informant was having these conversations not only with this inmate but with others for the express purpose, as he testified at trial, of trying to elicit incriminating testimony that might be helpful for his own situation?
Right. I believe a careful look at the record will reveal that on page 158 of the appendix, the snitch Trinidad said this was the very first time he had used testimony to his benefit. He had met Maldonado in October, had talked to Maldonado over the course of 2 months, had met Nieves in December for 2 days when they were in the same pod, and then in January went to his attorney and said, "Do you think this stuff could help me? This is by no means a government agent, a government informant, someone who's wearing a wire, someone that would bear any of the trappings of a government agent." It was a casual conversation between acquaintances. A testimonial statement is not something like this. It's something
What's the definition of testimonial?
Where the primary purpose is to create an out-of-court substitute for trial testimony. Now, the Supreme Court has said that Bryant and Williams and Davis, but they have helpfully provided what I would call categorical examples of how this primary purpose test works.
And in your examples, perhaps you could take into consideration what is of concern to me, and that is really the multiple layer here of witnesses, or you can look at it as a double hearsay sort of problem.
Right. So Crawford has said that there's basically two types of testimonial statements. There's prior testimony, which wouldn't apply, like depositions, affidavits. And then there's formal, quote, formal statements to government officers. Now, the Supreme Court has never held that that something other than a formal statement to a governmental officer is a testimonial statement, other than Bold Cumming and Melendez-Diaz, which are very similar to formal statements to governmental officers because they're reports prepared for the express purpose of a conviction or a prosecution. Now, what we have on the other side, the non-testimonial categories, statements from one prisoner to another, and Davis specifically said that's clearly not testimonial. Statement made unwittingly to a government official, clearly not testimonial. Statements made because of an emergency, Crawford says an offhand overheard remark. Crawford says a, quote, casual remark to an acquaintance. Statements to a child from a child are probably never testimonial. Statements to a non-law enforcement officer are, quote, significantly less likely to be testimonial.
But they didn't rule that out, and that was the Clark case.
That's right. It has not been expressly ruled out.
And I went through all these cases at the U.S. Supreme Court, and I found that they got various definitions of what primary purposes or various statements, and that you don't have all of the justices agreeing as to a statement of primary purpose that fits confrontation, and that the primary purpose differs depending on the context and on the nature of the statements. Or maybe you disagree with what I just said as my analysis of the cases.
Right, I don't disagree.
You do not disagree.
I do not disagree that the justices have struggled to have a uniform definition.
And they haven't made it.
They have not. What they have said is a primary purpose to create an out-of-court statement, and they've used these categories as sort of categorical. What Justice Scalia said in Crawford I thought was helpful is that the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause he said, is more about a categorical constitutional guarantee as opposed to an open-ended balancing test. Because that was a problem with Ohio versus Roberts. It was an open-ended balancing test. But the confrontation clause was meant to cure a specific type of evil, those found in the Marion statutes, those types of statements that Sir Walter Raleigh, that were used against Sir Walter Raleigh, statements made in England that were magistrates of the court, officers of the court, would go out and would formally take a statement against someone, come back to the court, and then use that in the trial against the purpose.
What Justice Scalia said in Crawford is, we leave for another day any effort to spell out a comprehensive definition of testimonial. And then he said, it applies at a minimum. And then he said, prior testimony at a preliminary hearing, police interrogations. These are the close modern practices with closest kinship to the abuses at which the Confrontation Clause was directed. Then, did Scalia write Davis? I thought that was true. And in Davis, one of the definitions of primary purpose is that it was potentially relevant to a prosecution. And if it was potentially relevant to a prosecution, it's testimonial. That's what I think Davis said. And that Davis has been repeated in Bryant, and Clark, too, had that potentially relevant as a primary purpose definition.
Yes, Your Honor, and Davis also said that a statement between inmates is, quote, clearly not testimonial.
Well, that depends, Counsel, doesn't it, on the fact that the inmates don't have any relation to law enforcement, right?
I think that's an open question. What I would say is that every federal court of appeals to have considered the issue, I count 8 of them, have said that even government agents, people hired by the government, undercover, wearing a wire in prison, are not testimonial, including then-Judge Sotomayor in the Second Circuit case of Saget, had a recorded undercover confidential informant conversation, said this is clearly not the type of statement that would be testimonial under Crawford.
Okay, so what you're saying then is that the question that we have to answer is the intent of the declarant, why they're making the statement?
No, the intent would not matter. This is an objective test. What you should view yourself as a reasonable outside observer, knowing all of the relevant circumstances. Now, we would say that...
What is the reasonable outside observer looking at? That's what Justice Kelly's question is.
Do we have to look at the declarant and try to figure out whether the declarant is trying to create a substitute for court testimony? Or do we have to look at the person who's receiving the declaration and figure out if he's trying to make a substitute for court testimony?
In Bryant, the court said you clearly look at both as a combined, they called it the combined inquiry, and they disagreed with Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg, who said that you should only look at the position of the declarant. So in Bryant, our most recent case, we do have this language saying we should look at the combined inquiry. But
well, if we look at a combined inquiry, then don't we have to, can the state still take advantage of the categorical exclusion of government informants as being necessarily non-testimonial? Or would you have to consider what is the relationship between the person receiving the declaration and law enforcement?
So I think our case law is in a state of flux right now. I would definitely agree with that. And what I would say with the government informant case is that you would look at the position of the declarant. What is he? Who is he or she? He is an inmate. What is the type of conversation you're witnessing? Is it a formal statement to a police officer, or is it more of a casual conversation between acquaintances, which this court in Jensen and Manuel versus State have said, like a spontaneous conversation between two people. But if you look at
what if it wasn't so spontaneous for Trinidad? Let's treat it, and you say that this is the first time that he used testimony in exchange for consideration by law enforcement. What if he was sitting there in his jail cell and thinking to himself, if this is what I need to do, I'm in a bad way, I need to go drum up some good, useful, valuable information. So I'm going to go trolling my fellow inmates to see what kind of evidence I can gather that I can then turn over to the police. Does that make any difference in the calculation?
First, just to tie it to the record, in the case, Trinidad said, quote, at first I wasn't looking into any cooperation at all. And the first time I did this was with Maldonado in his case. There was no agreement with law enforcement. There's no evidence in the record that he intended to do this before he heard the information, as if he was going out to seeking the... But
you're
hypothetical,
though. I think your opposing counsel might disagree with that.
Yes.
But speak to me in theoretical terms. Would it make a difference if he had had the intention of gathering this information for the purpose of turning it over to law enforcement? Because if you can tell me that doesn't make a difference, then we don't have to deal with whether what he was actually thinking, and your opposing counsel, he'll have to deal with that in his argument. But if that is a factor, then perhaps we have to look into those facts.
I would say that is a factor to determine, as the reasonable observer, what are the two relative positions of the individuals. But I would say that this is not the type of statement that the Sixth Amendment intended to reach. The Sixth Amendment did not intend to reach casual, spontaneous, private conversations. Maldonado said, I spoke in Spanish because I knew no one else in the pod spoke Spanish, and I wanted to keep it a secret. That's not the type of statement that someone says, like in Crawford, where they're giving a recorded statement to the police about how a woman was beaten by her husband. Or a statement, a battery declaration, like in the case out of Indiana. This is not where the police have come in and said, please give me your formal statement. That is the type that was allowed to be introduced in the trial of Sir Walter Raleigh. That's the type that was introduced under the Marion statutes. And if we move more towards the open-ended inquiry, then we fall back into the Roberts versus Ohio territory, which is just the open-ended balancing test. And why don't we just use hearsay? Why don't we just use the good old hearsay rules? Well, Crawford rejected the hearsay rules as a constitutional trigger. They said that this is about a specific category of statements that was supposed to be excluded by the founders when they wrote the Sixth Amendment.
Did Trinidad... as best from this record, can we infer that he knew that what was being said might be relevant to a criminal prosecution?
We don't know that until in January when he approached his attorney in law enforcement that he made the suggestion. We don't know whether his attorney suggested this to him or whether he had some sort of intent on the outside.
If you watch any TV, you know that the jail people are snitches. And that they use it for purposes of reducing their sanctions in their own case. I mean, you know, this is not a secret.
Yes.
Say 90% of the TV deal with that. So it's not a secret. So he knows. And our friend, the declarant here, knows too. Because he's keeping it secret because he's speaking Spanish. Why? Because he doesn't want one of these other people who he thinks is going to be a snitch to report it and be part of the criminal prosecution. This is potentially relevant to the criminal to the criminal prosecution. And don't both the declarant and the Mr. Trinidad know that?
The declarant certainly didn't know that because he wouldn't have said it if he thought this was going to be used at trial against him.
No, because he thinks he's talking to a friend who is confidential, right? I mean, how long do these guys know each other?
What I struggle with is I'm not sure how we get over Davis's language that says that this is clearly not testimonial. The Supreme Court said that statements between inmates are clearly not testimonial. I'm not sure what
What's the precise language from Davis?
Statements between inmates, which was in parentheses, they said these are the types of things that are clearly not testimonial.
I know, but Trinidad can be viewed as being more than an inmate.
He was an inmate at the time, and he had no relationship with law enforcement.
Right, but you could be both an inmate and be connected to law enforcement, can't you?
You could be, but he wasn't, yes.
Okay, because there's nothing in the record to show that he ever snitched before.
He has never snitched before this moment in 2010.
And he never considered snitching before.
Excuse me, ma'am.
And he never considered snitching before. Is there anything in the record that indicates he had considered that?
There's nothing in the record. In fact, he says, at first I wasn't looking into any cooperation. This is page 158, 159 mm-hmm. of our appendix.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key statement to see what his sort of intent was. But he said the first time was Maldonado's case. But I think bringing it back to that, even if there was an agreement, even if he was a confidential informant, even if he had been hired by police, there are 8 Federal Court of Appeals cases that say, including one by Judge Sotomayor, that said, this, we have no problem with this type of thing. This is not the type of statement that the Sixth Amendment is getting at.
So, counsel, then what you're saying is that we don't need to consider the relationship between law enforcement and the person who is witnessing the declaration.
I don't think, based on what we have with Davis and the precedent that we have in this case, that this is a difficult case. And I think that...
Before we get to whether it's a difficult case or not, I'm just trying to figure out what it is I'm supposed to consider. Right. So I need to know whether I need to look at Trinidad and say, well, what was his purpose for engaging in this conversation? Do I need to care about that?
I would say no, because the case law so far says it is an objective test. And so it's not the subjective intent of the speakers.
Right, but the subjective part that I mean, that just puts me on the outside looking at these two players. It doesn't tell me what I have to look at. So when I'm objectively looking at Maldonado and Trinidad, when I look at the Trinidad side of that, am I objectively looking at whether he's engaging in this conversation for the purpose of creating a substitute for court testimony? Is that what I'm supposed to look at?
So are you speaking about the declarant or the questioner, Trinidad or Maldonado?
Trinidad. Let's stick with him for a minute, right? So your opposing counsel is going to say, look, he was intentionally developing this evidence for use in trial, so that's why it's testimonial. So let's look at that and whether I have to care about that. Because obviously a government informant, if he goes in wearing a wire, he's there to develop evidence for trial, right? And you're telling me that Davis tells me that's okay. Don't you worry about that. He can be there for the purpose of developing information for trial, and that's not testimonial.
Yes, because it's a combined inquiry where you look at both sides. And you look here and you say, Trinidad's an informant, or Trinidad's an inmate, Maldonado's an inmate. These comments are casual in nature. They're between two inmates, and the government is not involved. Those are the facts I would look at to say that the primary purpose
but
is not.
But if the government was involved with Trinidad, we would need to consider that.
That would be something to consider, and to consider whether those 8 Federal Court of Appeals cases were wrong. That would be...
But your position is, I don't have to do that. Those 8 Court of Appeals decisions were correct. You don't need to care about whether Trinidad was an agent of the state.
I would say after Bryant, where they looked at, they said that the 3-year-old clearly didn't have the intent to make a formal statement to the police, and that the teachers clearly didn't have the intent to make a formal statement for a prosecution when they were talking about this child who had been harmed. That Bryant certainly muddies the water about what does it mean to be an objective test, because they do, in Bryant, in fact, look at the intent of the child and the intent of the teachers. So I would say in the combined inquiry, but I would say this is in a state of flux, the combined inquiry would include the intentions of both sides, as best as you could tell, as an objective outside observer, knowing all the relevant circumstances. And so I know there's this tension between what's an objective and what's a subjective test, but here, any objective observer would see Maldonado in Trinidad speaking in a pod in the Milwaukee County Jail in Spanish, and that would have no comparison to the types of testimonial statements that Crawford was talking about. It's just in a completely different realm. And so, but even if we move off of this and say that there was, you know, this was testimonial, under Bruton, the statement must be powerfully incriminating. It must be devastating to the defendant under Bruton. And it should be as if the co-defendant pointed directly to the defendant in the courtroom.
How about this as a statement? As I recall, it's akin to the statement in Jensen, but I will put it in the facts of this case. What if Trinidad was told this by Johnny Maldonado? Maldonado said to Trinidad, hey, this character named Boogeyman says he's going, and I'm doing this really for Justice Ziegler's benefit, I think you asked that I ask this question. This character called Boogeyman said he's going to kill me. So, Mr. Trinidad, if anything happens to me, I want you to know that. Now you've got conversation between two inmates. What's the confrontation analysis with regard to that?
That's very similar to the Jensen
case,
right?
That's exactly it. You mentioned Jensen earlier.
Woman goes to the neighbor and says, my husband might kill me. If it happens, here's some information. And then she goes to the police and says, my husband might kill me. If something happens, here's some information. In one, the court said it was testimonial. In one, the court said it's not testimonial. I think that's in line with the cases that say casual conversations between neighbors are not testimonial. And so this would be another casual conversation between two individuals. These are not formal or solemn declarations. These are not affidavits or depositions or hearing transcripts or a written statement, I confess to this crime, signed Johnny Maldonado. These are casual statements, and if we're going to move away from the intent of the Sixth Amendment, then we're fall dangerously back into Roberts territory, where we say, why don't we just go back to the good old-fashioned hearsay rules? And for that reason, we ask that the Court of Appeals decision be reversed. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Grau, and I represent the defendant, Mr. Raymond Nieves. With the court's permission, I would like to kind of reframe things a little bit and go to an issue that I think is important on behalf of Mr. Nieves that I believe we're kind of skipping over here. And the issue is whether or not Bruton was limited by Crawford to testimonial statements. I think from our standpoint, the whole issue of whether the statement was testimonial or non-testimonial really isn't the key issue in this case. We do not think that Bruton has been limited to just testimonial statements. There's a number of reasons for that. First of all, Crawford and Bruton are totally distinguishable on the facts. Crawford deals with the admission of evidence by a witness that is not confronted or not capable of being confronted by cross-examination. It deals with the admissibility of evidence. Bruton did not deal with that issue. In Bruton, it was assumed that the evidence given by a co-defendant, the statements given, was inadmissible as to Bruton. So we don't have a question of admissibility. What we have is a question of what to do with an inadmissible statement that's heard by a jury. How do we handle the prejudice to the co-defendant who did not make the statement? So what Bruton did was say, you sever, or as later case law developed, you got some other options. So these are two totally different situations. So I think that the existence of those different situations was actually referenced in Crawford. You go over and read these cases and see things, you haven't seen before. I'm not a historian. I don't pretend to be one. But when I was reading Crawford, Justice Scalia was discussing the development of the confrontation right, confrontation clause we have, but the right of confrontation. And he identified different fact situations. It became important at arraignments to have the right of face-to-face presence at an arraignment. Strict rules of unavailability were developed. He identified one recurring question was whether the admissibility of an unavailable witness's pretrial examination depended on whether the defendant had had an opportunity to cross-examine him. To me, that's Crawford. But he identified another situation that implicated the right of confrontation as saying several authorities also stated that a suspect's confession could be admitted only against himself and not against others he implicated. That's a different situation from the situation we have in Crawford. So I think the threshold issue is, does Crawford do anything to Bruton? No. And I think this is also borne out in the language of Bruton. The concern there is that co-defendants and the use of a co-defendant's testimony against another co-defendant who really can't get up or cause anyone to testify about it. The concern in Bruton, the language in Bruton, looked at whether or not the co-defendant who did not make the statement could be treated fairly. The court had to decide what to do in that situation. And some of the language is very important, I think. The language in Bruton says, an important element of a fair trial is that a jury consider only relevant and competent evidence bearing on the issue of guilt or innocence. This doesn't go to the admissibility of a statement by another witness. This goes to what to have a jury do, and what are we going to do as far as a jury hearing testimony they should not hear. Also, a statement, some language in Bruton, the government should not have the windfall of having the jury be influenced by evidence which, as a matter of law, they should not consider, but which they cannot put out of their minds. And there's another passage that I quoted in the brief. I won't read it here, but it talks about the extrajudicial statements of co-defendants being laid out in front of the jury. Those extrajudicial statements in Bruton were statements that the jury was not supposed to hear as far as Bruton was concerned. They were not relevant to him. They were hearsay as to him. They would not have been admissible at his sole trial. That's an important consideration. That's an important difference. And what the court in Bruton did then was go on and also talked about, in support of its decision, it cited Jackson versus Deno. And Jackson versus Deno was a due process case, not a confrontation clause case. And Jackson versus Deno had addressed the question of voluntariness. And I think that was a New York statute that was involved. The jury was required to consider whether the confession was voluntary or not. It wasn't determined by the court ahead of time. The problem with that was that a jury could find, and you wouldn't know what happened, could find that the confession was voluntary and so considered it, could find that it was involuntary and ignored it, or could have found that it was involuntary but believed it anyways. So you don't know what the jury is going to do. So to have a fair trial, the court in Jackson versus Deno says, jury instruction, and there would be a jury instruction saying you can only use it, you know, for this purpose, if you find it voluntary. The court said that's not enough. A jury instruction is not enough. Defendant won't get a fair trial. We don't know what the jury is going to do with this. I guess we don't trust juries to do this correctly. In Bruton, the court did say it may be a denial of due process to rely on a jury's ability to disregard a co-defendant's confession. So we're looking here at due process implications in Bruton as well. We're not just looking at the Sixth Amendment, although under the Sixth Amendment and Confrontation Clause, it is still different. It involves co-defendants, which we're not talking about in Crawford. Another comment in Bruton was, you don't sacrifice constitutional principles for convenience, the idea that we need joint trials. These are considerations that go directly to Bruton situations. All this testimonial and non-testimonial stuff has nothing to do with this. It doesn't cover a fact situation where a jury is going to hear testimony as to one co-defendant that it should not hear. This is the Crawford case just deals with admissibility of witness statements. It doesn't deal with the Bruton situation. And what we have in this case, it was mentioned at the motion hearing, that the testimony as to Maldonado vis-a-vis Nieves would have been hearsay. The state said yes. So they didn't litigate whether or not this was evidence that could be admissible as to Mr. Nieves. So these cases are completely different. As I said...
Counsel, assuming you're right, would this be subject to a harmless error analysis?
Well, I think harmless errors always apply.
And how do you overcome that hurdle?
I think the Court of Appeals did a good job of relaying the facts of the case here, and just this is not harmless error.
Is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision that you would change?
I hadn't thought of that. Not the result.
Really?
Other than that, honestly, no.
Nothing comes to mind.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
As I understand your argument, you're saying this might be testimonial and might not. You'd prefer that it be treated as testimonial because that's favorable to your client, but it doesn't matter. What we really have here is the use of a confession or admission by one co-defendant that is used against the other co-defendant because it implicates the co-defendant. And the your client cannot cross-examine the co-defendant because he's unwilling to testify, and that's his constitutional right. So what you have is a due process problem here of this testimony, which is harmful or prejudicial, in your opinion, used against him, and therefore that's contrary to due process. And that's the second part of Bruton.
Yes, there are due process implications.
Right. And that's what Brennan said in Bruton.
Yes.
And so the answer on harmless error is your position is as prejudicial, just as it was in Bruton, because the jury, even with a curative instruction, cannot, according to Bruton, ignore this confession. Is that a good summary of yours?
I agree, yes.
All right. So what's the matter with your argument?
What's the matter with him?
Yeah.
He thinks it's perfect.
He likes it.
Yeah. Well, as I understand it, the weakness that the state says is, hey, not testimonial, it comes in so long. Now, I wonder whether or not you have to get to the constitutional issue because, and you know, we try and avoid constitutional issues if we can base something on an ordinance, a statute, common law, because the statute here says in the last sentence, I think it's the last sentence, shall, right? You know the state statute I'm talking about?
971-12-3?
Pardon me? Yeah.
971-12-3.
So why aren't we just dealing with that statute? And the statute says shall, and here it fits that sentence, shall is mandatory, so long.
That's what I believe. And beyond that, I think the statute covers this case directly. And the parties
that's
were...
That's what I'm asking you.
I'm sorry.
That's what I'm asking you, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I do. The statute covers, and the parties were acting under the statute, and the statute was cited in the motion. Now the statute says, I think it's plain as day that there shall be severance. But there is case law that has come down saying in certain situations you can instruct and excise. I call it excision and instruction. If you can, and you still would satisfy the statute. I think the plain language of the statute says you don't do that, but that's the law.
But was there a curative instruction here?
No. No, there wasn't. And that brings me to something I did want to comment on, if I could. I think if I read the state's brief correctly, and I might have got things confused, people confused with my brief, but the state is saying that since there was no, the failure to have an instruction was waived, that argument is waived by the defendant. And I believe it was in the petition for review they first mentioned that, and we filed a response saying, no, no, the case they cited was Pagano, and 320 Wissecond, I think 348. That was another acts evidence case. And in Pagano, the court did say that in that circumstance, limiting instruction is desired, but it's not required, if I remember correctly, something like that. But this is not another acts case. This is a case where the law says there shall be a limiting instruction. Now, to say in this case that the defense was the responsible party to seeing that there was a limiting instruction in this case, that's just wrong, I believe. This was the state opted for this procedure of, instead of severance, which is what the defense asked for, they asked for this procedure where they would ask orally questions of the snitch, informant, in such a way that they would be able to keep out any reference, which is what the law requires, any reference to the co-defendant. If they opt for that procedure, it is the state's duty, in my opinion, to see that there's limiting instruction. We haven't forfeited that. I got into issues of forfeiture, et cetera, because later on in the brief, because I was concerned, to be honest, if it's found that Bruton is limited to only testimonial statements, I don't know what you do in a situation like Bruton, because in that case, the evidence comes in. It's not admissible as to a co-defendant. Apparently, if it's non-testimonial, it comes in, even though it's not admissible as to a co-defendant. So what do you do? I don't think the state's given us an answer to that, because now you've got a jury that's heard evidence they weren't supposed to hear as to Mr. Nieves with no severance. And
why aren't they supposed to hear it for Mr. Davis?
If it's
testimonial, why can't they hear it as to Mr. Davis?
If it's non-testimonial.
Non-testimonial, I'm sorry.
Because, well, it might not fit any of the exceptions to the hearsay rule. That wasn't litigated here. The court conceded
in
Nieves.
If it's non-testimonial, then you get to the hearsay rule.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if the hearsay rules say it's not admissible, which in Bruton, it was agreed that the testimony was not admissible as to Mr. Bruton, what do you do in that case if that was non-testimonial? Now you have a jury that's hearing evidence it's not supposed to hear. The least you should do if Bruton is limited to testimonial statements is, in a case like Mr. Nieves, there's got to be at least an instruction to the jury in non-testimonial cases where the evidence is not relevant. And that's, I raised that, under due process. You need an instruction. You need the jury to be informed what the rules are.
Counsel, before you get to that step, do you need to have a conclusion that the statement explicitly implicated Mr. Nieves?
You're getting into the testimonial, whether it's testimonial or not, I think.
Well, Bruton itself says, doesn't it? Perhaps I'm wrong. But Bruton says that rule applies only if the statement expressly implicates, right?
Well, we can differ on what expressly implicates. I think the Court of Appeals did a good job. The case law shows you got to show that there's absolutely no reference to the co-defendant.
He's expressly indicated. He wasn't named.
Not
so
named.
So what's the reference?
They laid them down in the alley.
The reference is they.
They.
And that you have to then argue that they, the inference is they means your client.
And I don't think, honestly, anyone could read this record in the entirety and context and say that they did not include my client. I think in one of the cases it talked about, if there's any concern about who they are, the jury just has to look up and see who's on trial there. There were only two people on trial. This wasn't a conspiracy of 30, 40 people, anything like that. They and the state framed the case in its opening statement and argued in closing who the they are. We know
they
who
are
they
who?
Are.
They are who?
Maldonado and Nieves.
Okay.
I'm probably, I think, the only person maybe on the bench who has tried cases in the federal system that involved Bruton issues and also in the state system. Bruton One way of making your argument clear would be, if these trials were severed, this testimony would not have been admissible in your client's trial, right?
Yes.
And therefore, these statements should not be admissible in a trial where they are not severed, right?
Well, they should not be in an ideal world, yeah.
How do you deal with Richardson versus Marsh, where confessions or statements can be admissible if it just kind of connects people together without directly implicating them?
Well, in Richardson versus Marsh, I got to remember the facts, so sometimes I go a little off on it.
That's right.
Marsh was the defendant, and she testified in that case. And in that case, there was no reference, if I remember the facts correctly, there was no reference in the statement to her. It was only when she got on the stand, I think it was a conversation in the car between some perpetrators about what they're going to have to do after kill somebody, whatever. They didn't reference her at all. But when she got on the stand, she said she was in that car. So then, you know, oh, yeah, she heard all this stuff. So that's a different factual situation than what we have here. And I don't think it really sheds any light on the problem in this case, because my client, Mr. Nieves, did not get on the stand. He didn't get on the stand and do anything or say anything that focused the they on him. The use of the word they is focused on him and his co-defendant by the state, by the witness, by everybody else. He did not do that. He did not provide, I think, the contextual implication that they referred to him. That didn't happen in this case.
The state takes the position that Mr. Trinidad didn't, before this instance, consider, if I understood the state, and they can correct me when they come back up, didn't consider that this conversation would ultimately be used in a prosecution, and cited us to pages, I think it was 158-159. Were you the trial lawyer here?
Justice Abramson, I was appointed to do a reply brief. I didn't do anything, even the main brief. So
well,
here I am.
The reason I ask this is because on pages 173 to 182 of the appendix is the cross-examination of Mr. Nieves' counsel. And then he said, and that shows that Mr. Trinidad has had six convictions. And although when he was talking to Mr. Nieves, he had not yet talked to the cops about Mr. Nieves, and he got no agreement from law enforcement or the DA's office about whether he'd be treated better. But it talks about that on page 181, you've cooperated with the police and a variety of other inmates in the Milwaukee County Jail, correct? Correct. And then he says, I know of at least two, and then they stop that line of questioning. But preceding that, he's asked, at that meeting with the police, you and your lawyer made it clear you were looking for a benefit? Yes. You weren't just doing it out of the kindness of your heart? No. And at that time, there may not have been a specific agreement with the cops, but that's what you were looking for? Correct. Otherwise, there's really no reason for you to do it? Correct. Now, Mr. Maldonado was not the only person about whom you met with police in order to discuss potential benefits, correct? Correct. Do you think that you can make the case that he was an agent of the police and that this was questioning by the police for purposes of prosecution?
You know, that is certainly something that should have been looked into and would have been looked into, I think, if there was a hearing addressing these issues. And then one of the reasons we oppose the motion for reconsideration to raise this issue is because I don't think the record's all there. We're trying to figure out what happened in this case by what was testified to at trial. If we were going to have a case that addressed the issue of whether these are testimonial or not testimonial statements, that should have been raised at the trial court and litigated. And I think it was one of those Wisconsin cases that indicated, it might have been Jensen, that's a trial court determination. That wasn't done here. But I think that does get into something. Oh, I'm sorry.
But no, you finished that.
That does get into something, the testimonial, non-testimonial dichotomy here. If we get to that point, to be honest, I'd be guessing if I tried to tell you what the rule is going to be regarding testimonial versus non-testimonial statements if it is applied to a Bruton situation. Because there are some considerations that I can glean from all these cases about what we look at when we're trying to decide testimonial or non-testimonial. A major concern is how evidence is obtained. I think one of the concerns expressed was, if I could quote, involvement of government officers in the production of testimony with an eye toward trial presents unique potential for prosecutorial abuse. Now, that's a general statement, but it does give a serious concern. So that's a concern, is how was the evidence obtained? And in a case of co-defendants, and I think the fact that they're co-defendants in that type of situation is an important factor that would enter into any test that might be developed. Another thing we learned from the case is that facts are important. Whatever the facts, I think citing a 30-year-old case to say that this certain kind of, this testimony is testimonial or not testimonial, I think that's, we don't know that the 2015 case of Clark is changing the rules. We don't know. I don't know. But these considerations are there. Facts are important. The definition is in flux. I know Justice Scalia wrote Crawford, and by the end of these cases, he's dissenting.
But he wrote Davis, too.
And Davis, right? Yeah, right.
But then he didn't agree with them in Clark v. Ohio.
Right. He's in dissent because Ohio. They're getting away Clark from what. So I don't think you could cite to Davis necessarily and Crawford as being a last word on this type of case. The court has specifically not addressed this issue. And that goes back to my interpretation of our statute. Why would we reinterpret our statute as far as Bruton is concerned when that issue specifically has not been addressed? There's no reason to reinterpret our statute. Bruton is Bruton. That has not been reevaluated in light of Crawford.
I'm sorry I can't find it at the moment, the concept of whether it's testimonial is contextual. You have to, which is what you're saying. You have to know the facts. And then your argument is that testimonial was versus non-testimonial was not debated at the trial.
Right.
Therefore, facts that would relate to it are not in the record.
That's right.
That's your position,
that's
if
right.
I understand it.
That is correct.
Therefore, this court shouldn't rule on testimony or non-testimonial here.
That's why I wrote in opposition to the petition for review. I don't think that the facts are here for this court to make.
So what kind of remedy do you want should you win? What did the Court of Appeals say we do?
The Court of Appeals reversed his conviction, and I'd ask that the Court of Appeals' decision stand.
So you want a new trial?
Yeah.
Are the witnesses still alive? Is that in the record?
I don't know.
Okay.
I honestly don't know. Just a couple other things, I think, as far as the testimonial, non-testimonial. Some of the things we know, another thing about these cases, even though they're different situations, some are, there's the domestic violence case, there's the case at the gas station, the shooting, they all really were focused on one issue, and that was whether or not there was an ongoing emergency. And that was the focus of all the cases, I think, except Crawford. So what do we know about that? We know that if the evidence does not go to an ongoing emergency, but goes to past events, that's a consideration. That fits our case, definitely. If a party, they did consider whether or not a 911 operator was acting as an agent of police, So it seems to be that whether someone's acting on behalf of the police or not, that's a consideration. These are all considerations coming out of these cases. I don't profess to know how that will be applied or the test will be formulated in a Bruton situation, but I think all these things are things that would have to be considered.
Well, what about all the federal cases that we've been referred to that say one inmate talking to another inmate is not testimonial?
It depends on the facts. You know, I just think you can't make a blanket statement like that. I just think you got to look at the facts of the case. And I think that is clear from these cases. It depends on the facts of the case. I think, you know, there has been the statement that offhand remark to, say, another inmate or something. Well, there's nothing offhand about what happened in this case. I mean, this man was on a mission. He wanted to help the state. He wanted to obtain evidence. You can't look at this in any other way.
Why can't we look at that in any other way? What evidence in the record is there to establish that Mr. Trinidad had as his purpose the trolling for useful information?
If I recall, he met with police officers three times prior to court, and when he was still in the process, I thought, of trying to obtain information.
I'm sorry.
Of obtaining information. And he also, he testified that this is something he does. I think there was even a complaint against him for trying to shake down people and get paid so he would avoid testifying against them. So,
was that before or after the conversation with Mr. Maldonado?
I don't recall. That's the kind of stuff that would have been gone into if they had had a hearing to explore all these facts.
There was some noise, and I couldn't quite hear your response. Were you saying that he met with law enforcement three times during during the course of the time that he was obtaining this information from Maldonado? Did you say that?
That's my recollection. Okay. If I'm wrong, I apologize, but that's my recollection, what the testimony was. That's really all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have just a couple points in rebuttal. First, in the statute, when it was passed in 1969, the legislature included a specific note that said that this statute provides a mechanism to ensure that trials will be conducted in conformity with Bruton versus United States, which prohibits the use at trial of a statement of a co-defendant which implicates another defendant. So the legislature specifically said this statute is for Bruton.
And which Bruton, part of Bruton? The due process part or the confrontation part?
The confrontation part.
Okay.
And so
even if Bruton is changed on confrontation, doesn't mean the statute doesn't deal with due process.
Well, the specific statute that was referenced talks about separating the trials when a statement implicates the other defendant.
Yeah.
And my point is simply that the legislature intended this to be a codification of Bruton. And Bruton has never been understood to be anything other than a confrontation case.
Bruton is quite clearly a due process case when you read it. Brennan did both.
My second point is that this is not a due process case. The due process issues haven't been fairly presented here. And if this becomes some type of a due process case, it's basically just a garden variety hearsay case.
Aren't you relying on harmless error?
Yes, we are.
Due process? When you say it's harmless error, it means it didn't affect the bottom line of the case?
Yeah.
But if it does affect the bottom line, then it's a due process issue.
Yes, considering all the evidence in this case, the short statements of Maldonado and Nieves, which comprises a short part of the record, are cumulative of Davis's testimony, David's testimony, the eyewitness who gave a compelling account of the case from start to finish.
Do you agree that if these trials were severed
these statements would not have been admissible?
I think that the statements that the very few statements that Nieves made about himself would have been admitted in Nieves' trial, and the statements that Maldonado said about himself would have been allowed in Maldonado's trial.
Right.
That's.
But that's not what is being argued here. It's the intersection of statements made by one that it's argued are being used against the other because the trials were not severed. I mean, the answer would have been to sever these trials.
Right.
Instead of having this case come all the way to the Supreme Court, it would have been much cleaner.
Right. It would have been easier for the trial judge to deal with this, to separate out the statements.
Had they done that, would this evidence have been admissible against this defendant?
The statements that Maldonado made, that's the subject of here, would not have been in Nieves' trial because Maldonado was not available. And so they would have, if they were deemed testimonial statements, then they would not have been involved. But they were not testimonial statements. So there's no confrontation problem.
Well, what about hearsay, though? You wouldn't get them in. I mean, what exception to hearsay could you get them into his trial if they had separate trials?
Right, so the question is whether it would have been a statement of a co-conspirator. I assume it wouldn't be because the conspiracy was not ongoing, but you know the catch-all provision of hearsay, there could have been a question about the overall reliability of the statements. I'm not sure what the trial court would have done with hearsay in this question.
Specifically this question, did he talk about... When he spoke of the period of time, and this is a question to Trinidad, did he talk about, when he spoke of the period of time they were in Kenosha, where they were at, where he was with the shorties in Kenosha, Trinidad, I believe Mr. Nieves' mom's house, or his baby mama's house, would that have been admissible? If it had been severed.
So, first question, is it testimonial? We'd say it's not testimonial. Assuming it's testimonial, we would say, is it powerfully incriminating? If there's a joint trial, we'd say it's not powerfully incriminating. Then your question is, if it's severed and there's two different trials, would that have come in? I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you very much.
That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you.
Well, this is a very, very interesting question.
Thank you. We will give it careful consideration as we do all of our cases. Your briefs were exceptionally good, and we appreciate that because it makes our job easier when you do a really good job on your side of the case. So thank you. We're going to take a brief recess now so the people who are here for the next case can get set up and ready to go.